Take a network break, help yourself to a virtual donut and a fresh cup of coffee. Today, we're going to look at proposed new requirements for reporting security breaches to the federal government, how Intel's foundry business is bleeding billions of dollars, updates on the seventh generation of PCIe, and more tech news. We're joined today by guest commentator Jonatil Johnson, founder of the research firm Nemertes. We're sponsored today by Nokia. Its network operating system, SR Linux, is built from the ground up to simplify data center operations and integrations while giving you the ultimate in visibility and flexibility. We recently recorded a Tech Bytes with Nokia that dives into how SR Linux supports automation, orchestration, and customization. You can get the link to that in the show notes for today's network break episode to hear it. And you can find out more about SR Linux for yourself at learn.srlinux.dev. I also just want to let you know we've launched a bunch of new shows recently, including Network Automation Nerds with Eric Cho. You can check out his most recent episode with guest Kirk Byers, where they talk about Python and network engineering. You can find all of our podcasts, including Network Automation Nerds, at packetpushers.net. Okay, before we get into the news, we've gotten several FUs on various shows and subjects, so we're going to run through them real quick. First, a listener wrote in to offer a counterpoint to the praise we've given to Juniper's Mist AI wireless product. They write, Juniper Mist AI is not that exciting. Every time I hear Network Break talk about Mist AI, I have to wonder if the hosts have ever tried it beyond a tightly controlled vendor demo and press releases. I've also seen those demo presentations from my local Juniper rep, but conveniently ask Marvis the same questions. Then afterwards, I go to my own account and ask the bot what's wrong in my network. It can never give me any useful information back. In my latest attempt, it would not even acknowledge the existence of the broken network component. I've seen better results in products that have got good basic search bars without any AI. Sorry for the rant and don't mean to come across as a hater, but I always cringe when I hear this mentioned on Network Break. And finally, time to say something. When I heard it referred to as a level 3 AI in Network Break 472, he also doesn't think that HPE acquired Juniper for the AI, but rather that Juniper was looking to be acquired. And he says, thanks for the podcast and have a great day. So appreciate the friendly ending there. And we're always welcome of criticism.
I know. And that's someone who's on the ground, who's actually using the product. I guess most of my perception is coming from people who use the product on a daily basis, who do say positive things about Mist and say that they are generally able to be more operationally effective. And I think it is fair to say that, you know, Mist is conceptually a level 3 AI. It's not just like an LLM model trained on, you know, 10 years of tech cases and documentation and community forums sort of thing, right? But he may have a point that it doesn't work for everybody. I'm a big believer that not every product works for everybody. And the question that I then have is, in this situation, is there something unique here? Or is it just that his situation, the AI functions that Mist has, is not working? I mean, I think, Drew, we have to be realistic and say that AI doesn't solve every single problem in the world. It's just if you need to hit something with a hammer, you know, there's 10 different types of hammers. We don't use just one hammer to do all things. Sometimes there's a sledge, sometimes there's a carpentry hammer, sometimes there's a blacksmith's hammer. These are different tools for different things, but we just call them all hammers, right? So
right.
I don't know. It's fair criticism. I think it's absolutely fair to say we shouldn't overblow that Mist AI doesn't bring world peace to network operations. So fair comment. I'll take it as a given. Yeah.
Yeah, same thing. My context for Mist is that I've spoken with multiple customers, including large ones who have had who praised the operational capabilities. I don't know if there's maybe a difference between sort of the background operational capabilities of Mist and interactions with the Marvis chatbot. Maybe that still needs some things worked out. But in any case, we as commentators here do need to be careful that we also don't get sucked into the hype that the vendors generate, especially around new technology. So yes, we appreciate.
And this is why we have the FU, the follow-up, right? So you can come back to us and tell us no harm, no foul, and say and put the record back in balance. This person's experience is valid.
Absolutely.
His experience of Mist AI is mediocre at best, and that's probably absolutely fair criticism. And yeah.
Yeah,
but I'll also stand by my point of view that if you pull back a little bit, I think that Mist AI is doing more than for more people generally. But again, no vendor solves all the problems. So
absolutely. All right, moving on to our second FU. In a recent episode, we mentioned serious vulnerabilities in F5 and ConnectWise that were being actively exploited. A listener wrote in to say, some quick context for the ConnectWise vulnerability you covered recently. Their Screen Connect remote management tool that had the issue is popular with MSPs, so it's installed at a lot of small and medium business who have, quote, implicitly agreed to it, but probably have no idea that it exists. The other major player in the RMM space, Kaseya's VSA, has also had some pretty terrifying vulnerabilities and was once used as a ransomware attack vector. So one wonders, how much should any person trust any of these tools? So appreciate the feedback on that.
The real question here is, should you trust a managed service provider? And given the number of vulnerabilities we've seen in managed service providers and their software supply chains over the years, the answer is probably no. See, if you're an MSP and you're using ConnectWise to do remote administration of desktops and laptops and all that sort of stuff, right? And the same with Kaseya's VSA, which was one a while back. It also comes back to what SolarWinds was doing. They were selling a version of their monitoring and help desk management software to customers, and their software supply chain was compromised. So the question now is, are managed service providers keeping these products up to date? Are they securing them, or are they just sort of installing them and crossing their fingers? Like, if you work for a managed service provider with 1,000 people doing the remote support, who's paying attention to the technology details about, is ConnectWise secure? Are we deploying ConnectWise in a secure way? People are probably just sitting there going, like, it's working. Don't ask any questions. I just want to go home. So, yeah, should you trust any of these tools? No. Should you trust your managed service provider? I think trusting a managed service provider is false economy. It'll always come back to bite you. And I understand, you know, this person's point is that if you're a small to medium enterprise, where else are you going to go? It's a tough situation.
Greg, I think the fix here is at least inform yourself. If you're going to be using a managed service provider, make sure you know what tools they have and that you explicitly agree to them. In that case, you're no worse off than you would have been doing it yourself. From everything you know about the tools, you would have bought those tools yourself, then it's no worse off. But yeah, you can't get away without knowing what the tools are.
Yeah. And I mean, the metaphor I would use here is many small businesses outsource their accounting to a company, but they still have a bookkeeper in the house. And if you're going to do the same with your IT, you still probably want to have somebody watching your MSP. And that's the role of the bookkeeper, is to watch what the accounting is doing to make sure that they're not making mistakes.
All right, our last FU before we get into the news. It's the 25th anniversary of Cisco's Cat 6K. We've gotten several FUs of people delighting sort of in the longevity and reliability of this product. But I'll read one here. A couple of years back, my team inherited stewardship of 4 6500s with over 14 years of uptime on each. Since then, the two have been replaced and one did have a power failure, leaving one. I'm trying to keep going until the campus it sits on completes its switching refresh. I'm probably sure you'll get someone messaging with greater uptime, but this one stands at 15 years, 5 months, and 8 days so far. So some appreciation for Cat 6 robustness.
Now, this person knows the game because somebody has, since the time you put this in the document, Drew, sent some FU in, and they're saying that 15 years and 5 months, or a bit longer than this. So yeah, I've seen lots of stories about this. I am personally, my sense of self-loathing and horror around having worked on the 6500 is roughly akin to, I spent a lot of time trying to make Cat 6500s work, and they were a miserable experience. The product was awful. It was overly complex for solving really simple problems. If you had lived in the 6500 ecosystem long enough, you had to start messing around with things like Cisco ACE modules and FWSM modules, which turned out to have more problems than they solved. We went through a period of doing ISSU so that you could, you know, these were going to be the next form. And ISSU on the Cat 6500 never worked. The TAC never, ever recommended it. They went to all this trouble to produce this code. And somehow I think people are looking back at this as a fond time when networking was perfect. It wasn't. The 6500s were horrible. They were appalling. They were, you know, you would put one in and it wasn't uncommon to spend 3 to 6 months finding a version of code that was compatible with all the modules and line cards that you had in it, and then trying to find a version of it that was stable. So, you know, if you bought a car and you spent 6 months waiting for it to start working and then all of a sudden it worked for 15 years, you might forget the 6 months, but it doesn't for me. No, the 6 months I remember.
But it never forgets.
Now, my view is that the platform should have been vended around 2010. It was obsolete at that point. It was clearly obsolete. And it was also very clear at that time that the software quality issues around the iOS SX that was running on that was just never going to be addressed. And I know some of what happened behind the scenes with that code version and just how badly developed that was now. And I know why it was awful. But the story I've heard is that Cisco had a few key customers who had massive orders, and Cisco was on a 10, 20-year supply contract for these things. And so they kept shipping them because they had this thing in place, and customers weren't really saying to Cisco, we should change. And Mark Abel popped up in Twitter in response to my questions and came out with an absolute cracking line. His line was, Cisco propped up the 6500 and carried it around like Weekend at Bernie's. Which is pretty funny, because it was. It was a you know, dragging a corpse of a 6500 around for about 5 to 10 years longer than it really should have been. That's absolutely a comedic image I'm going to take into this week.
That is excellent. Yeah, I do think there is a human tendency to develop nostalgia for things that are just around for a long time, whether it deserves that nostalgia or not. And it's clearly the effect happening around the 6500.
Yeah, I think the fact that something ran for 15 years is a signal to the fact that you finally got it stable and nothing else. And that's how it should work, right? It's not supposed to work better than that. That's nominal condition. It should work stably and reliably for so long. The fact that it ran for 15 years is probably not a feature, because it means that your IT environment hasn't changed or upgraded in that time frame, which is a bit embarrassing. And, you know, potentially it should have, I think. So I'm always a bit mixed. My feelings are mixed. But anyway, my memories of the CAT 6500 tend to involve self-loathing, the waste of my life doing rather pointless work instead of doing valuable work for customers. I was doing pointless stuff. So.
All right. Strong feelings. Well, you got to follow up too. And as always, if you've got questions, comments, corrections, observations, hit us up, packetpushers.net/FU. We do love to hear from you, and we do welcome all feedback. All right, let's dive into the news. First, a U.S. federal agency has proposed rules that require organizations to report security incidents within 72 hours of becoming aware of the attack. Organizations that pay a ransom after a cyber attack will also have to file a report within 24 hours of paying the ransom. These rules are coming from CISA, or the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. The rules are currently open for public comment.
So lots of things happening here. One of the things is, of course, we've had a theme here on Network Break for a long time saying cybersecurity or security doesn't matter because nobody gets punished. And this is a step away from that, Drew. That's obviously, if you've got to report the things that you got wrong to the government, not just for public companies, by the way, because public companies now, we talked about, they have to report to the SEC in a couple of months.
Yep.
No, they have to report to the SEC now, actually.
It came into force.
Yes, I didn't know it came into force. Yep, everybody filed their first ones in March, or at least everybody with a fiscal year reporting requirement.
But this one is, I think, what Drew, you know more about this than me, but this is actually organizations that are federal agencies. So like
it's federal agencies and private companies. So both. Okay. Yes.
This covers the gap of the private companies. The problem with it is that the government has to get its act together. There's a whole question, and in fact, I've read it, and there's a whole question about what the definition of a serious incident is. They don't have a good definition, and there's no guarantee that the definition that they're using is the same definition as a material cybersecurity breach that the SEC is using. So now a lot of companies are being put in the position of having to report the same thing twice with two different definitions, with a whole bunch of different rules. You know, I'm as fond as the next person of making sane government regulations to control things, but I would suggest politely that the government try to get its act together and not, well, the SEC is private, but still, the fact that there are conflicting regulations in play is a problem in my mind.
Yeah. So this is a U.S. thing for everybody who's outside the U.S. This isn't something that's, I think
it's inside baseball. Yes.
I think it is going to sort of roll out more widely. This is a rather obvious thing, is that the cyber authorities in each of these countries needs data. So from my point of view, we need a logical extension on how to handle cyber instances. Cyber instances as a national and to some extent an international. And the first step on that is some sort of data gathering, right?
But we already have that, is my point. And my point is, if you're going to
only for public companies.
Yes,
only for public companies.
But a number of public companies, Greg. If you're going to require people to report, require them to report once to one agency everything that they've got, not this patchwork quilt of agencies.
So potentially we'll see the SEC change this situation around, because you're right. You know, having a public company report to the, you know, to the cyber authority and to the SEC, but the SEC is doing it for shareholders, right? So it's a different thing. Who knows how that will resolve itself out? My question is, can this body do this execution? So companies don't like reporting to the government unless the government happens to be giving them free money and they resent the overheads imposed. Can this body enforce actions to make executives respect the requirements? And can they be seen to be doing something useful in the event of a major incident? So, you know, if a major healthcare institution like we've seen recently gets taken down and they're in a 2-week outage, what does this program eventually lead to? Does having that data collection and those reports turn into something workable, or is it just a body that's doing a thing. So, for example, the counter argument here is the FCC has just started a program to look at the SS7 protocol that interconnects telco networks, especially voice and circuit switch networks, but also packet networks. And SS7 is a protocol used by telcos and the OSS BSS layer to do settlement, usually for billing and also to set up circuits and so forth, right? The challenge is that SS7 is not encrypted, has assumed trust and no validation, no authentication, no encryption, right? So somehow the way that we handle SS7 is we do it all after the fact. We run them in VPNs and all that sort of stuff. And it's been so vulnerable that we've had international telcos established by threat state nations just to connect to SS7 so they can wiretap people, so they can trace people around the world. And now the government's suddenly saying, well, you've got to start talking to us about SS7. The FCC saying, we need to decide, you know, we need to do something about this. So the first step is doing a consultation. Well, if you've got a buddy reporting, collecting cyber threat data on these types of things from countries, maybe we wouldn't have to do this consultation. Maybe there's a central repository where you could look at cyber data. So I think it's a good move by the US government. I've got questions about execution, because execution is always challenging for governments. And Then I've also got questions about what do they do with that in terms of giving value back to the corporate companies.
And I have questions about definitions, because I think it's incredibly important. And in fact, in the CISA regulation, there is a whole host of questions about what an attack really is. And if you've got varying definitions by varying bodies, you're just going to have a mess. You're not going to have that happy result that you're looking for, Greg.
Probably a process issue that'll get fixed.
All right. Yeah, I just want to note that this isn't meant to be something punitive. CISA is saying the goal is to help identify threats against critical infrastructure more quickly. They can share threat information to help other entities protect themselves. And the overall goal is enhance the country's cyber resiliency. So yes, there are always issues with these kind of regulatory requirements, but it is actually already a law. It was passed in 2022. CISA is just trying to get it implemented now. So this is happening. It's on the books. If you have feelings about it, we are in a public comment period. I think it's open through June. So you can go in and have your say. And then a final ruling is expected sometime in the end of 2025. So keep an eye on this, because it is going to affect lots of people. I'll also just say that one of the new podcasts we've launched at Packet Pushers is called Packet Protector Security Podcast. I'm co-hosting it with Jennifer Manella, and we just did a whole episode on this that'll be coming out soon. So if you are interested in diving in, keep an eye out for that. Now we'll move on. Intel says its foundry business lost $7 billion in 2023. That's on top of losses of $5.2 billion in 2022. These details are coming from an SEC filing the company made as it sets up a new financial reporting structure for the foundry operations.
That's almost real money, Drew. $7 billion?
Ooh, that's serious.
Serious money?
Serious money.
Yeah, this was a pretty not unexpected. I've talked a bit in previous shows about the financial engineering that the previous executives at Intel did, where they maximized profits. And basically, Intel decided that in order to be much, you know, to present their vision to shareholders and also to the market and customers, they've decided to break out the financials for their fab operations for the first time. And what happened was what people thought. That is, Intel's been doing some accounting to move around the losses in the fab from making Intel CPUs into the fab unit. So that is, the cost of producing the Intel, you know, CPUs that it sells into the wider market has been subsidized by losses in the fab market. And now Intel's basically breaking them out and saying, we're going to run each of these as a profit center in its own right. So to try and justify the fact that the fab unit lost $7 billion, real money, Intel says operation margin improvement is expected through shifting volume mix to leading edge extreme ultraviolet nodes. What they're saying there is they don't use those advanced nodes today. They're shifting from the technology they've been using for the past 20 years and shifting over to EUV. And they're trying to achieve, as they say here, process parity and leadership. Intel Foundry expects to drive further operating margin expansion by manufacturing a larger percentage of Intel's products, growing its high-margin advanced packaging business, continuing to expand its external foundry business, and blah, 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 right? So what it's saying there is we're looking to find people who are going to bring their manufacturing to our fab. We're right. going to grow our packaging business, because once you've made a chip, it then has to be packaged up to be doing something useful. And that's quite often a third party. That's not always done internally at the fab. But if you can do it at the fab, in theory, you get a shorter time to market, which is desirable. And I think the challenge here is that what Intel's trying to say is that they're trying to keep up with TSMC. They want to be the default competitor to TSMC. And so Intel's going to have to spend heavily to upgrade to the newest equipment. You're going to have to build new fabs. They're going to have to find thousands of employees who are going to run these plants 24/7. They're going to have to throw away all of their legacy technology that nobody was using. Only Intel CPUs were running on Intel's fab technology. So they're moving to the EUV stuff. And then they're saying that it'll contribute to profits in 2030, Drew. 2030 in the stock market, that's 5 years away. That's like, I'm pretty sure there's a shareholder going something. What, 2030? I can't hear you. Can you say that's 20 quarters away? What the hell?
Yes, they're expecting losses to increase in 2024. I guess they're getting all the bad news out in front now. They expect to break even sometime between now and 2030, which is really not what shareholders want to hear. But as I said, I think Gelsinger is getting all that bad information out in front because they know this is going to be a rough ride.
Yeah, I think Intel's going to be in trouble. They're saying probably Intel's still profitable. By the way, let's not at all make the case that Intel is struggling here. Intel is still profitable. The profit margins that it makes on those CPUs is just phenomenal. It's managed to maximize the revenue from those very well. But the assumption is that if Intel needs to grow, instead of just making CPUs and doing, you know, being a one-horse pony, it's going to have to do this fab business, and they've basically bet on it. And it would be fair to say that while Intel has good GPUs and its Gaudi AI is a fine chipset, it's still not getting the same sort of press coverage like that AMD or, and of course, NVIDIA or even Broadcom starting to brag about its AI chipset lately. And Intel's got a tough time ahead of it. And that's why its share price fell 10% when this announcement came out and it laid out the new operating model. But, you know, 10, 20 years of financialization of a company, so same as what happened to IBM, also happened to Intel. There's a good chance that this will turn around. But it's going to be slow, 2030, before we see something at Intel turning to a leader again, I would say.
Yeah, just a couple of notes. We talked last week about how Intel is poised to get billions of dollars in funding from the U.S. So that they're trying to patch that hole with taxpayer dollars. And CNBC reports that Intel put out a promo video that said much of the lack of the profitability in its foundry business was due to the weight of past decisions. And separately, Pat Gelsinger cited the company's past slow adoption of UEV technology. So to my mind, that's Gelsinger saying, don't blame me. Other people messed it up. I'm here to try to clean it up. So even though we've got some very bad predictions of the future, please let me stay. I will fix it.
He's been saying that for a couple of years now, Drew.
Well, he's still in charge, so it's worked so far.
I mean, he's got a lot to do. To be fair, he's got a lot to do. There's a lot, he's managed to get rid of, you know, sell off a couple of business units. He's made some restructuring, got the FPGA business unit, Altera, floated out into a separate company. So it's not like nothing's happening. He is making progress. So I think the market will tolerate it for a while longer.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, let's pause for a message from sponsor Nokia. Why should you care about the network OS running your data center? Nokia designed SR Linux to support automation, orchestration, and customization. In a recent Tech Bytes podcast, we dig into SR Linux's support for Yang and GNMI and how that support ties into northbound orchestration platforms. We also discuss how SR Linux provides streaming telemetry and Nokia's development kit that lets you customize this Linux-based NOS. You can find that Tech Byte in the show notes that accompany this episode, which is Network Break 473, or just search packetpushers.net. You can also get more details for yourself about SR Linux at learn.srlinux.dev. That's learn.srlinux.dev. Back to the news. A draft of the 7.0 version of PCIe has been released. Gen 7 increases bus transfer speeds to 128 gigabits per second or 512 gigabytes per second. That's across 16 lanes. The official specification is expected in 2025.
And products aren't expected till 2026-27, Drew. So don't hold your breath if you can't wait for PCIe 7. So I guess the question here is, why does PCI matter? And the answer is, it's the bus that's most often used inside a server. So the path between the CPU and the GPU and the network card and so the NIC and so forth, it runs over a PCI bus, and that's where the daughter boards go. And for right now, there's a huge demand amongst high-performance compute and AI-type workloads where moving data between the elements of a server. So for example, NVIDIA's Blackwell superchip last week, you're starting to talk about, you know, it just needs as much data. And NVIDIA went to the point of inventing a replacement for PCI because it was just so slow and not optimized for this type of purpose. So PCIe 7 is a step in that direction. And the faster you can move data around, the cheaper it is to run AI and HPC workloads. Well, cheaper in the sense that power and hardware is needed to perform the same work. And if you choose to process and compute more, then you don't actually save money. You just get twice as much compute for the same money as you're getting before. So it's always one of those things. It's like every time we get a new switching ASIC, six switches get rolled into one, but most people just find ways to use more bandwidth. So the way to think of PCIe, and I think we talked about this a month ago or so, is that PCIe is also a rack scale network. So what I mean by that is we're seeing PCIe move away from just being inside the server to actually becoming a backplane where servers inside a rack. So it's a super high speed interconnect. And we've seen a lot of development around a technology called CXL. And so CXL is roughly similar to IP, where if PCI was to Ethernet. So if PCI is like the physical logical layer, then CXL is what IP is to Ethernet. It's a data plane and stuff. It's a set of protocols for cache coherency, memory expansion, and a range of other stuff, right? And so the idea would be here is that you would have a rack, and in the back of that rack, it looks like a chassis backplane from top to bottom, and you just start slotting servers home into that, and the PCIe bus goes all the way up and down. And so I'll put a link in the show notes here, Drew, to an announcement from Samsung, and they're talking about a CXL memory module box. The memory module box is so that you can actually put CXL connected or memory modules, DRAM, a combination of various types of DRAM, high-speed DRAM that you want, and you put a big box of them at the top, and then you rack your servers underneath, so compute, CPU. And this means that you then take that memory modules, and then you say, oh, I need 128 gigabytes for this server, I need a terabyte for that server. So you don't end up with what they call stranded memory. You don't have a bunch of servers in a rack, and this server needs to have five times as much memory as this one, but I can't move it between the servers, right? So I have, remember composable infrastructure from 5-10 years ago? Do you remember
that? Yes, I do.
CXL is the instantiation or the physical elements of that coming out. I sort of didn't know if it was going to get anywhere, but what's becoming clear is that if I look at the NVIDIA GB200 Blackwell supercomputer things, that's what they're doing. They're doing NVLink up a backplane in the back of that rack scale architecture. And then up and down that runs NVLink, InfiniBand, and Ethernet. And they're not doing composable, you know, the CXL memory module thing. But the idea is that eventually an enterprise would go and buy a rack. The rack has a passive backplane. You put a box of memory modules in the top, and then you allocate them to the servers. And then you put a bunch of NICs and InfiniBand adapters and whatever. Sort of back to where we were with blade servers in the early days, in a way, conceptually similar, but not at all the same. It'll actually work a lot better because people have taken time. You're not relying on a small company like HP or Cisco comparatively to try and build a backplane that actually works, and then fumbling the ball and producing something that's a miserable failure.
So
that's why PCIe 7 matters. The faster you can go, faster you get to rack scale architecture, because you've got to be, if you're going to send CPU request to a box on the top that's full of DRAM, that's got to be like really fast and zero latency sort of thing. So
all right, things to keep an eye on. We'll move on. AWS is laying off hundreds of employees as the cloud computing giant reckons with a slowdown in sales. Their parent company, Amazon, is also laying off thousands of Amazon workers. The AWS cuts are coming in the company's physical stores tech unit, as well as in sales and marketing.
Amazon put out a press release saying it laying off 9,000 employees, including many from AWS. I've heard the numbers is thousands. We've talked before about AWS is sort of basically signaling that its growth is slowing. It's not shrinking. You know, where before, you know, 5 years ago, it was growing at 40% per quarter, then it became 40%, 20%. AWS is certainly slowing down its growth. It's now talking about spending $10 billion a year, where before it was spending $40 billion a year sort of thing, right? And that's because the demand for its products are starting to slow down. There is a counter argument here. Some people push back on me and said that AWS is hiring just as many as it's firing, which is a good argument, because sometimes these companies, it's cheaper just to fire people than it is to relocate them inside the business. So there's a career tip here, Drew, as you've no doubt you've seen, because you've worked inside big companies. If you can see this coming at your employer, get out there and start canvassing for new roles inside the company before the cut comes. Because what happens is, once upon a time, HR would have gone and redeployed you elsewhere in the organization. That's not what happens now. It's cheaper and simpler for companies just to throw you in the trash can. If you want to stay where you are and you don't want to get the redundancy payout, and sometimes maybe getting the redundancy is worth it, right? Because some of the tech companies have pretty generous termination terms. But if you can see it coming and you want to decide, get out there and find a new role for yourself. That's a quick career tip. So I don't know. What do you think, Drew?
The tech sector is constantly seeing this these tides of layoffs that happen for various reasons. It could be related to financial performance. It could be related to we overhired, or this project didn't work out. Or in some ways, I think a lot of the tech layoffs in the past, say, 6 months to a year or so, was a way of the tech companies sort of reasserting control over rest of populations who were like, no, I don't want to come back to the office. And they said, okay, well, then we'll start firing people and see how you feel about coming back to the office then.
Yeah, people still didn't come back to the office yet, but there you go. So we'll see. We'll see.
It's
wins.
A push and pull. And in a related story, Amazon is discontinuing its Just Walk Out feature in its Amazon Fresh stores here in the U.S., where customers didn't have to use a checkout machine or work with a cashier. Instead, cameras tracked what they picked up and then just charged their Amazon account automatically. The tech was hailed as a harbinger of our new automation future, but the information reports that, in fact, it was bolstered by more than 1,000 human workers in India who monitored the cameras and labeled the videos to make sure the checkout was accurate.
And so there, I think we see the flip side of the laying off all the humans working in the cloud services, but we're hiring, or at least we have previously hired, thousands of humans in India watching cameras, which I find extremely interesting.
Yes, and I'm guessing that the cost to employ workers in India is much cheaper than the cost to employ workers here in the
US. Yeah, so what we
US.
Have here is just a plain old 1980s era example of outsourcing.
Yes.
When I first wrote it, I thought Just Walk Out would be the name of our return to office strategy. People going, no, I'm just go to the office and just walk out. No, Just Walk Out was actually what they used in shops. They have a bunch of fresh food shops in, I think it's the US and UK, it may be in other locations, yep. But I'm not 100% sure, the Amazon Fresh stores. And the idea was that people would walk in, scan a QR code, walk around to a bunch of shelves, pick up whatever they wanted, and then just walk straight out. No need to hit a till. Yep. And a bill would automatically arrive. It turns out that Just Walk Out, this technology relied on more than 1,000 people in India watching and labeling videos to ensure accurate checkouts. So in effect, they just moved the cashiers off-site, which is kind of an interesting model. The response that they put out to the press, there's a couple of articles here at Gizmodo and the information. Their response was that we're actually teaching our machine learning data. So these are machine learning data associates who are annotating video images, which is necessarily for continuously improving the underlying machine learning model, right? So what they're saying here is that they were basically training the model. And I would say to you that what they basically admitted is that this process isn't going to work. This is a project. It was quite widely deployed. Lots of stores, you walk in, you walk out. People were complaining that they were being charged for stuff they didn't take. It was very accurate, or the invoice would take hours to arrive. But it seems pretty clear that the machine learning models, or the AI, what we would now call AI, didn't work. You could train it all you like, but it wasn't accurately getting the things right. So they're abandoning the walk-in, walk-out sort of a thing. I can't help but wonder if there's like some social issues here too. As we see society get more polarized, we're seeing a lot more petty theft here in the UK. And I've seen some articles about the same in the US. So maybe, you know, having open stores where you just walk in, walk out, isn't working while the current social disruption's happening as well. I just wonder.
I was wondering about that. Yeah, and it always seemed like a very dumb idea to have, you know, come here, grab all you want, and pay on the honor system.
Yeah, it's like the
well,
story
it wasn't really
about
the honor system. It was a pay on the surveillance system. It just turned out the surveillance system wasn't as good. So
yeah, well, it's like the joke about having a doorman on a hotel. The doorman on the hotel doesn't actually do a whole lot. And if you're from a straight financial point of view, you don't want to have a doorman, right? It's just an expense. What's the point? The doorman's just there to stand at the door and welcome people and maybe help them with their bags occasionally and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that when you get rid of the doorman, you get, you know, people coming in and out of your hotel, you lose control of your physical security, you know, all that type of stuff. And so most hotels have a doorman, not because it's, you know, to maintain the who's coming in. Is the hotel lobby got nice people in it? Are they, you know, is the hotel bar a peaceful place and so forth? And so I think it's this sort of thing. You just have to have tills and people go through the till, because that's how you get the sort of environment where people buy goods and transact them in a clean, well thought out way.
Well, I think this lends to sort of a broader question about AI and what executives think about AI. And I didn't put that in the show notes, so maybe I'll drop it in. A survey came out from a staffing provider called the Deco Group in the UK, in Europe. They interviewed more than 2,000 large companies worldwide, and 41% of senior executives expect to have smaller workforces because of AI technology, meaning they'll be able to get rid of people, or at least they assume they will. And I think Amazon was experimenting with, do we need actual people in our grocery stores? I think it turns out that you do. So I don't know if the AI will let us fire, you know, lots of our workforce to make us more profitable will actually pan
maybe
out.
Maybe not in the future. Maybe society will change and it will couldn't return in the future, perhaps. But we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. All right, and finally, from our not a surprise file, Juniper shareholders have approved the acquisition by HPE. More than 256 million shareholders voted yes, compared to just over 258,000 who voted against.
That's pretty much overwhelming support. There's no reason for this to be not go through. It's really all I wanted to say about this. I don't see any people pushing back against the acquisition. About 60% of Juniper shares are actually held by funds and institutional investors. I did a quick look up, and they obviously aren't opposed to the sale. They think the price is fair and reasonable. So, and I have no expectations that any sort of anti-competition body or trust body will come up and say, this isn't fair. I don't see any reason why somebody, you know, the competition authorities would step in and say this is an unacceptable consolidation. So it's on track and it'll happen. I just wonder why it's going to take a year. I would like to see this happen faster than the current plan. I would like this happen ASAP and get Juniper and HP working to build, you know, better stuff together than instead of going through the sort of the slow death that happens once these things go, you know, as these things go through.
Yeah, and I think the theme of this news and the whole episode is really everything old is new again. You know, gee, we have to have people in stores. Gee, Juniper, shiny new Juniper actually works better when it's combined with HP, which is a good old workhorse from the, you know, from the 70s and 80s. So it's kind of interesting that there's a lot coming full circle, especially with the, you know, the opening FU about the Cisco gear. It's just interesting to see that everything old is new again.
Classic in tech. All right, that wraps up our news portion, sir. We don't have a tech bite. So, Greg, if folks want to find you online and get more from you, where should they go?
I'm still expostulating occasionally on Twitter and LinkedIn. If you want to follow me on those, then you can probably get putting together a lot of the thoughts that come into this episode. So if you want to see it in flight, get the stream of consciousness, follow me on either of those mediums.
Jana, how about you?
Go look me up at nemerdes.com. I also hang out on LinkedIn.
I will also say Jana puts out a weekly newsletter that's very good. So if you're interested in that, I highly recommend it. I'm Drew Conrad Murray. I am on LinkedIn as well. And I'm also on Blue Sky if you want to visit me on the socials. Thank you to our sponsor, Nokia. And thanks to you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, leave a recommendation on Apple Podcasts. You can find all other podcasts wherever you get your podcast listening. As always, thanks for listening.